Ali visited his other Arab friends, and his briefcase was soon full of enthusiastic letters of recommendation written by the leaders of the Buenos Aires community. At the end of July 1961, Kamal Amin Tabet flew to Zurich, changed planes, and proceeded to Munich. At the airport of the Bavarian capital, an Israeli agent approached him. His name was Zellinger. He handed Ali his Israeli passport and a plane ticket to Tel Aviv. In early August, Ali came home. "I'll spend some months at home," he said to Nadia. The following months passed in intensive training. Ali's cover was perfect, and he completely identified with his new character. His radio instructor, Yehuda, was back and trained him in radio transmission in code. After a few weeks, he was able to receive and transmit between 12 and 16 words a minute. He compulsively read books and documents on Syria, its army, weapons, and strategy. After myriad briefings by specialists, he himself became an expert on Syrian internal politics. In December 1961, Ali flew to Zurich again, but his final destination was Damascus, the Lion's Den. The tension on the Syrian-Israeli border had grown as the Syrian regime had weakened. Since 1948, a long series of military coups had shaken the country. Very rarely did a Syrian dictator die a natural death anymore. They died on the gallows, in front of a firing squad, or by the good services of an assassin. The unstable country was in constant turmoil. Quite often, eager to distract the public's attention from inner problems, the Syrian leaders deliberately caused border incidents. Public executions were a common sight in Damascus's squares. One after the other, the hangmen put to death people labeled as conspirators, spies, enemies of the state, and supporters of the former regime. Not long before Ali arrived, there had been yet another coup on September 28, 1961. It had put an end to the short-lived Syrian-Egyptian Union, pompously named the United Arab Republic. Before setting out on his mission, Ali met the ubiquitous Zalman, who gave him detailed instructions. "You'll get your radio transmitter from Zellinger, our man in Munich. After you arrive in Damascus, you'll be contacted by an employee of the Syrian Broadcasting Corporation. He, too, is an immigrant, like you, who has settled in Syria not long ago. He doesn't know your real identity. Don't try to find him. He'll find the right moment to establish contact with you." In Munich, Zellinger had for him an impressive package of spying equipment, sheets of paper on which the key to the transmission code was written with invisible ink, books serving as transmission codes, a special typewriter, a transistor radio in which a transmitter had been inserted, an electric razor whose cord served as an antenna for the transmitter, dynamite sticks hidden in Yardley soap and cigars, and some cyanide pills for suicide, just in case. Ali wondered how he would introduce all this equipment to Syria, where customs and immigration controls were thorough and severe. Zellinger had the answer. "You'll buy a passage on the SS Astoria that sails from Genoa to Beirut in early January. Somebody will get in touch with you on the boat. He'll help you pass the border controls in Syria." Ali set sail aboard the Astoria. One morning, when he was sitting close to a group of Egyptian passengers, a man approached him and whispered, "Follow me." Ali got up and strolled away from the group. The man told him, "My name is Majid Sheikh El Ard. I've got a car." That was a hint that he would drive Ali to Damascus. El Ard, a short, mousy man, was an international entrepreneur and a well-known and shady businessman in Damascus. He was married to an Egyptian Jewess, and yet he had chosen to pass the World War II years in Nazi Germany. His fickle and greedy character made him seem an unsavory partner, which attracted the Israeli service's attention. They soon made him their agent, even though he didn't realize it. He believed he was working for right-wing Syrian extremists who were acting undercover. He truly believed in Kamal Amin Tabet's legend, and in the coming years was to be of great help to the Israeli spy. His first task was to make sure that Tabet's baggage would safely go through Syrian controls. January 10, 1962, El Ard's car, coming from Beirut, was stopped at the Syrian border. In the trunk were Eli Cohen's bags, full of transmission equipment and other incriminating items. Eli was sitting in the passenger seat beside Sheikh El Ard. "We are going to meet my friend Abu Khaldun," El Ard told Eli when they approached the border. "He happens to be in financial trouble. $500 would certainly improve his situation." And so, $500 quickly made their way from the Israeli agent's wallet to the pocket of Abu Khaldun, the Syrian customs inspector. The barrier was raised and the car sailed into the desert. Eli Cohen was in Syria. In bustling Damascus, strewn with crowded mosques and colorful souks, it was not difficult to melt into the crowd. But Eli wanted the exact opposite. He wanted to be noticed, and fast. He rented a luxurious villa in the classy Abu Rahman neighborhood, close to Syrian army headquarters. From the villa's balcony, Eli could watch the entrance to the Syrian government's official guesthouse. His house stood among foreign embassies, rich businessmen's homes, and the official residences of the nation's leaders. Eli immediately concealed his secret equipment in various hiding places throughout the house. In order to avoid the risk of informers or traitors in his own household, he decided to refrain from hiring servants and lived alone. He was lucky again. He had arrived in Damascus at the right moment. The United Arab Republic collapse was regarded by President Nasser in Cairo as a personal affront and a humiliation to Egypt. The Syrian leaders, both politicians and military, were obsessed with the possibility of an Egyptian-inspired coup, and Israeli espionage was not on their agenda. On the other hand, they badly needed new allies, supporters, and sources of funding, both in Syria and among the Syrian emigres overseas. Kamal Amin Tabet, the staunchly nationalist millionaire, armed with excellent letters of recommendation, was the right man at the right time. Cohen established his contacts quickly and effectively. His letters of recommendation opened the gates to the high society, the banks, and the commercial circles that had inspired the coup of September 28th. His new friends introduced Eli to top government officials, senior army officers, and leaders of the ruling party. Two rich businessmen courted the young and handsome millionaire, hoping he would marry one of their daughters. In a display of generosity, Tabet contributed a substantial sum of money to the building of a public kitchen for the poor of Damascus. His new popularity paved his way to the governing circles, yet he refrained from identifying with Syria's new rulers, because he intuitively felt that this was only temporary. Syria was still to go through major internal aftershocks following the separation from Egypt. A month after his arrival in Damascus, Eli was visited by George Salem Saif, a radio show host in charge of Radio Damascus broadcasts for Syrians abroad. He was the man whom Zalman had mentioned at Eli's last briefing in Israel. Saif had returned to Syria a while before Tabet. Because of his position, he could supply Eli with inside information about the political and military situation. Saif also showed Eli the secret guidelines by the Ministry of Propaganda, outlining what he could broadcast and what he had to conceal from his audiences. At the parties held in Saif's house, Eli met several senior officials and well-known politicians. Saif, like El Ard, had no clue about Eli Cohen's real identity. He, too, believed Thabet was a fanatical nationalist who had his own political agenda. Eli Cohen realized that he had become the loneliest spy in the world, with not even one friend and confidant. He didn't know if there was another Israeli network operating in Damascus. He needed nerves of steel to withstand the stress of his terrible solitude and to play a dangerous role 24 hours a day. He knew that even during his rare visits home, he couldn't share his secret with his wife and had to mislead her, too. He started transmitting his messages to Israel daily at 8 a.m. and sometimes in the evening as well. His broadcasts were carried out under a foolproof cover. His transmitter was located in his villa, very close to the army headquarters, which was the source of endless transmissions. Nobody could discern the difference between Eli's broadcasts and the myriad messages emanating from the Army Communications Center. 6 months after arriving in Syria, Kamal Amin Thabet had become a well-known figure in Damascus high society. He then decided to go abroad for business. He first flew to Argentina, where he met several of his Arab friends, then traveled to Europe, changed planes and identities, and on a hot summer night landed in Lod Airport. Laden with presents, the traveling salesman arrived in his modest apartment in Bat Yam, where Nadia and Sophie were waiting for him. At the end of fall, Eli Cohen flew to Europe. A few days later, Kamal Amin Thabet arrived in Damascus. During his stay in Israel, his superiors in Amman had equipped him with a miniature camera so he could photograph sites and documents. He had to conceal the microfilms in expensive boxes containing backgammon pieces. The boxes were made of polished wood embellished with a mosaic of nacre and ivory. The mosaic ornament could be dug out of the polished wood and reinserted after the microfilm had been placed in the cavity. Thabet would send the backgammon sets to friends in Argentina, who would dispatch them to Israel with the diplomatic pouch. Some of the first documents sent by Eli were reports on the growing unrest in the army and the rising power of the Ba'ath, Resurrection Socialist Party. Eli felt a profound change of mood in Syria and let his intuition guide him. He established close contacts with the Ba'ath leaders and contributed large sums of money to the party. He had done the right thing. On March 8, 1963, a new coup shook Damascus. The army deposed the government and the Ba'ath party seized power in Syria. General Hafez, Eli's friend from Buenos Aires, was appointed Minister of Defense in Salah Abitar's cabinet. In July, a new coup took place, this time inside the regime. Hafez became president of the Revolutionary Council and head of state. Thabet's best friends were appointed to key positions in the cabinet and the military hierarchy. The Israeli spy was now a member of the inner circle of power. A glamorous party in Damascus. One after the other, the luxury cars of ministers and generals arrive at the sprawling villa. A long line of guests in evening attire and resplendent uniforms proceeds into the house, where the host is warmly welcoming his guests. The guest list reads like a who's who in Damascus. Several ministers, including the Minister of Defense and the Minister for Agrarian Reform, a large number of generals and colonels, the top leaders of the Ba'ath party, businessmen and tycoons. Many of them are standing around Colonel Salem Hatoum, the officer who led his tanks into Damascus on the night of the coup and actually handed General Hafez the presidency. President Hafez himself arrives later and warmly shakes the hand of the host, his friend, Kamal Amin Thabet. He is accompanied by Mrs. Hafez, stunning in the mink coat presented to her by Thabet as a token of the Syrian emigrants' admiration for the president and his wife. She is not the only one to have received expensive gifts. quite a few women wear the jewelry, and senior officials drive the cars, given them by Tabet. Important political dealers have deposited his money into their accounts. In the living room, a group of officials and army officers, back from the Israel border, discuss the military situation. They are joined by entrepreneurs and engineers who work on the ambitious project of diverting the tributaries of the Jordan River. In the spacious hall, the directors of the government-sponsored Radio Damascus and the heads of the Ministry of Propaganda stand together. Tabet is one of them now. The government has asked him to run some radio broadcasts to emigrant communities overseas. Tabet has another radio show where he analyzes political and economic issues. That party, as many others, costs Tabet a fortune, but he doesn't even blink. He has reached the apex of success, and it seems that there is no door he can't open. He has good friends in the Army headquarters, and he regularly participates in policy-making meetings of the Ba'ath Party. Eli kept transmitting reports of military character, names and functions of senior officers, top-secret military orders, and other items to Israel. He photographed and dispatched military maps, mostly the detailed blueprints of the fortifications along the Israeli border, to Amman. He sent reports on new weapons introduced in the Syrian army. He also described the Syrians' capacity to absorb new weapons. Months later, a Syrian general bitterly admitted, "There was no army secret that remained unknown to Eli Cohen." Eli transmitted every morning to Israel and didn't fear capture, thanks to the protective umbrella of the Syrian army broadcasts from the nearby headquarters. But once, a friend, the army lieutenant Zahir al-Din, paid him a surprise visit. Eli succeeded in hiding the transmitter, but a sheaf of papers with the secret code, in the form of grids filled with letters, remained on the table. "What's this?" Zahir wanted to know. "Oh, just crosswords," Eli said. Besides the transmissions and the backgammon boxes for his Argentinian friends, Eli developed a third way of communicating with Israel, Radio Damascus. He worked out with his superiors in Tel Aviv a code of words and phrases, which he inserted into his radio broadcasts and which were duly decoded by Amman. He now took another step in his efforts to obtain top-secret information. A rumor started running in the governing circles in Damascus that Tabet held illicit sex parties in his villa. Only his close, intimate friends were invited to these parties, where the guests met a large number of pretty women. Some of them were street hookers, others girls from good families. Tabet's guests enjoyed wild sex, but their host was the only one who did not lose his cool. Tabet also supplied sexy and generous secretaries to his high-placed friends. One of these friends was Colonel Salem Hetoum, whose mistress passed to Tabet every word she heard from her colonel. Tabet showed extreme patriotic fervor when he spoke about Israel, which he defined as the vilest enemy of Arab nationalism. He urged the leaders of Syria to increase their anti-Israeli propaganda and open a second front against Israel, besides Egypt. He even accused his friends of not doing enough against the Israeli aggressor. In doing so, he achieved his goal. His military friends were determined to prove him wrong and to show him they were ready for battle with the enemy. On three occasions, they took him to visit the Syrian positions along Israel's border. They let him see the fortifications and the bunkers, showed him the weapons concentrated in the area, and described their defensive and offensive plans. Lieutenant Zahir al-Din took him to the Al-Hamma military camp, where large quantities of new weapons had been stored. On his fourth visit to the Israeli border, Tabet was the only civilian in a group of Syrian and Egyptian high-ranking officers. The group was headed by the most respected Arab military leader, the Egyptian general Ali Amr, head of the United Arab Commandment, who commanded, at least on paper, the combined forces of Egypt, Syria, and Iraq. Right after Amr's visit, the Ba'ath leaders charged Tabet with a vital assignment. He was sent on a mission of reconciliation to the elderly Ba'ath leader Salah al-Bitar, who had been deposed by General Hafez and was since on a cure in Jericho. Tabet traveled to Jordan and spent a few days with the former prime minister. Back in Damascus, Tabet accompanied to the airport the ailing President Hafez, who was on his way to get medical treatment in Paris. When Hafez returned a few weeks later, Tabet was once again in the welcoming line, waiting on the tarmac, his mission successfully completed. In 1963, an important change took place in Israel. The new Ramsad, who replaced Little Isser, Meir Amit, had been for a few months in charge of both Amman and the Mossad. Amit decided to abolish Unit 131 and transfer all its men and operations to the Mossad. One morning, Eli Cohen learned that his employer had changed and he was now a Mossad agent. That same year, Nadia gave birth to a second daughter, Iris. But in November 1964, during his second visit to Israel that same year, Eli saw his secret dream come true. Nadia had a third child, a son. He was named Shaul. During that visit, we noticed that Eli had changed, his family members said later. He was withdrawn, nervous, and grim. He lost his temper several times. He didn't want to go out, didn't want to meet friends. Soon I'll quit my job, he said to us. Next year I'll come back to Israel. I won't leave my family anymore. At the end of November, Eli kissed his wife and three children goodbye and flew away again. Nadia didn't know that this was the last goodbye. November 13, 1964, was a Wednesday. Syrian positions at the Israeli border, close to Tel Dan, opened fire on Israeli tractors that were working in the demilitarized zone. The Israeli reaction was formidable. Tanks and cannon riposted with heavy fire, and minutes later, Mirage and Vautour aircraft joined the battle. The aircraft pounded the Syrian positions, then dived toward the site of the deviation of the Jordan waters and blasted the canals dug by the Syrians. Heavy mechanical equipment, bulldozers, tractors, and shovels were systematically destroyed. The Syrian Air Force didn't interfere, as it had not yet mastered its newly acquired Soviet MiG fighters. The world press almost unanimously validated the Israeli response to the Syrian aggression. Months later, Syrian officers would say that one of the Israeli attack's architects had been Eli Cohen, who was in Israel during the battle. Thanks to Cohen, the Israelis were fully aware of the poor state of the Syrian Air Force and its inability to go to battle at that stage. The Israelis also had detailed knowledge of the Syrian fortifications and the water deviation works. They knew exactly what kinds and quantities of weapons were positioned in each base and bunker. But Eli Cohen knew much more than that. He had succeeded in befriending a Saudi entrepreneur who had been contracted to plan and dig the first canals of the Syrian project. Thanks to that friendship, the Israelis learned months in advance where the excavations would take place, how deep and wide the canals would be, what equipment would be used, and other technical details. The contractor also divulged to his friend Tabet the capacity of the canals to withstand bombing from the air and the full extent of the security measures. The name of Cohen's good friend was Bin Laden, little Osama's father. Thanks to the detailed information he shared with the Israeli spy, Israel attacked the project several times until the Arab countries decided to abandon it completely in 1965. In mid-January 1965, a few weeks after Ali had left Israel, a beautiful postcard landed in Nadia Cohen's mailbox. "My dearest Nadia," Ali wrote in French, "just a few lines to wish you a happy new year, which I hope will bring happiness to the whole family. Lots of kisses to my darlings, Fifi, Sophie, Iris, and Saika, Shaul, and to you, from the bottom of my heart, Eli." When Nadia received that postcard, Eli was lying, beaten and tortured, on the rough stone floor of a Damascus prison. For several months already, the Syrian Mukhabarat, the secret services, were on high alert. The alarm had been sounded by Chief Tayara, head of the Palestinian Department of the Mukhabarat. Tayara noticed that since the summer of 1964, almost every decision taken by the Syrian government in the evening, or even during the night, was broadcast the following day in the Arabic language programs of Kol Israel, Israel's government-sponsored radio. Furthermore, Israel had made public some top-secret decisions that had been taken behind closed doors. Tayara was stunned by the precision of the Israeli bombings during the November 13th incident. His logical conclusion was that the Israelis had exact knowledge of the Syrian army deployment at the front lines and knew precisely where to hit and how. He became certain that Israel had a spy at the highest levels of the Syrian government. The spy's information was broadcasted by Kol Israel in a matter of hours. This meant he was transmitting his reports by wireless. But where was the transmitter? In the fall of 1964, Tayara and his colleagues made great efforts to locate the secret transmitter with Soviet-made equipment, but failed. And then, in January 1965, they got lucky. A Soviet ship unloaded in Latakia port several huge containers filled with new communications equipment. It was to replace the Syrian army's obsolete instruments. The equipment upgrade took place on January 7, 1965. In order to put in place the new devices and check them out, all army communications were suspended for 24 hours. When silence fell over all army communications throughout the country, an officer on duty by an army receiver discerned a single faint transmission. The spies broadcast. The officer reached for the telephone. Mukhabarat squads, equipped with Soviet locators, set out at once to find the transmission source. Unfortunately, the transmission stopped before they reached the place. But the technician's feverish calculations pointed in one direction: the home of Kamal Amin Tabet. "That's a mistake," a senior Mukhabarat officer ruled. It was unthinkable that Tabet, whom the Ba'ath leaders wanted to appoint minister in the next cabinet, could be a spy. Tabet was above suspicion. But in the evening, the transmission was there again. The Mukhabarat again sent its cars, and again got the same result. At 8 a.m. precisely, on a sunny January day, four Mukhabarat officers broke into the splendid house in the Abu Rahman neighborhood. They smashed the entrance door, tearing it from its hinges, and then darted toward the bedroom, guns in hands. The spy was there, but he was not sleeping. He was caught, red-handed, in the middle of a transmission. He jumped on his feet and faced the officers. He didn't try to run away and didn't resist his captors. For once, the odds were against him.
"Kamal Amin Tabet," thundered the commanding officer. "You are under arrest."
The news spread through Damascus like wildfire. Fantastic, absurd, impossible, nonsense. There were no words to express the shock and the disbelief of Syria's leaders when they heard the news. Could one of the leaders of the ruling party, a personal friend of the president, a millionaire and a socialite, be a spy? But the evidence was irrefutable. The transmitter that Tabet would conceal behind the window shutters, the tiny reserve transmitter hidden in the large chandelier in the living room, the microfilms, the dynamite-stuffed cigars, the code pages. The man was a traitor indeed. Panic-stricken, the heads of the regime ordered a thorough investigation. What exactly did Tabet know? Could he incriminate them? President Hafez himself came to interrogate him in his cell.
During the interrogation, Hafez later testified, when I looked in Tabet's eyes, I was suddenly assailed by a terrible suspicion. I felt that the man before me wasn't an Arab at all. Very cautiously, I asked him a few questions about the Muslim religion, about the Quran. I asked him to recite the Surah Al-Fatiha, the first chapter of the Quran. Tabet could barely quote a few verses. He tried to defend himself by saying that he had left Syria while still very young, and his memory was betraying him. But at this moment I knew he was a Jew. Damascus's torturers did the rest. While Tabet was still lying in his dark cell, unconscious, his face and body covered with ugly wounds, his nails pulled out, his confession was rushed to General Hafez. The man was not Tabet. He was Eli Cohen, an Israeli Jew. On January 24, 1965, Damascus officially announced the arrest of an important Israeli spy. A senior officer, livid with rage, roared at a press conference, "Israel is the devil and Cohen is the devil's agent." Panic spread throughout Damascus. Was Cohen a lone wolf or the head of a spy ring? One after the other, 69 people were arrested, 27 of them women. Among the suspects were Majid Sheikh El Ard, George Salem Saif, Lieutenant Zahar al-Din, senior officials of the Ministry of Propaganda, prostitutes, and other women whose identities were not revealed. 400 people who had been in contact with Tabet were questioned. The investigation exposed some serious problems. Many of Syria's political, military, and business leaders were among Cohen's closest friends. The investigators couldn't touch them. Their names couldn't be mentioned, as any public allusion to them could create the impression that they were complicit in Tabet's spying. The Syrians also found that Tabet had made every possible effort to prevent the publication of any contact between his various informants. Therefore, it was very difficult to establish the extent of the spy ring. In Israel, the military censorship imposed total blackout on any mention of Cohen's arrest. The Israelis still hoped to save him and were determined to prevent the news about him from reaching the local media. But there were some people who had the right to know. One evening, a stranger visited Eli's brothers. "Your brother has been arrested in Damascus and accused of spying for Israel," the man said. The brothers were stunned. One of them, Maurice, rushed to his mother's home in Bat Yam. "Mother, you should be strong," he said. "Eli was arrested in Syria." The old woman was speechless. Finally, she managed, "In Syria? How? Did he cross the border by mistake?" When Maurice explained to her what Eli was doing in Damascus, the poor woman collapsed. Nadia stood among her three children, astounded. Even though she had suspected all along that her husband didn't reveal everything to her, she never had guessed what his real line of work was. Elie's colleagues tried to calm her down. "You're flying to Paris right away," one of them told her. "We shall hire the best lawyers. We'll do everything possible to save him." Meir Amit personally took charge of the efforts to rescue Cohen. On January 31st, one of France's greatest lawyers, Jacques Mercier, came to Damascus. Officially, he had been hired by the Cohen family. Actually, it was the State of Israel that covered his expenses and his fees. He came to Syria on a mission impossible. "From my first day in Damascus," he said later, I realized that Eli Cohen's fate was sealed. He would hang. Now all I could do was try to gain time and work out a deal that could save his life. At first, Mercier tried to prevent a trial. He met with the regime's leaders and asked to be allowed to see Cohen in order to make him sign Mercier's appointment as his attorney. His demand was flatly rejected. Yet Mercier found out very soon that he had some allies in certain governing circles who treated the world public opinion with respect. They wanted a trial where the rights of the accused would be protected. They were supported, for a totally different reason, by the hawks in the military establishment, sworn enemies of Hafez, who wanted to expose the president's close ties with Tabet in open court. Such a trial, they thought, would make public the corruption of the regime and undermine its position. But this approach was bitterly opposed by another group, all those who had maintained close ties with Tabet. They knew that a public trial could send them to the gallows as well. That faction had one single goal: to prevent a public trial at all costs and eliminate Cohen as soon as possible. The trial finally took place before a special military court, behind closed doors, in front of an empty room. Only some portions, duly selected, were broadcast on the state television. There were no prosecuting and no defending attorneys. When Eli Cohen asked the court for a defense attorney, the presiding judge exploded. "You don't need a defender. All the corrupt press is on your side, and all the enemies of the revolution are your defenders." The presiding judge assumed the functions of interrogator, prosecutor, and judge. But the worst of it was that the presiding judge was Brigadier General Salah Dalli, formerly Tabet's good friend. Another close, even intimate friend of Tabet, Colonel Salim Hatoum, was among the judges. In order to disprove any rumors of his ties with Cohen, he asked him, "Do you know Salim Hatoum?" And the accused, like an actor who follows a detailed script, turned to the empty courtroom, then looked Hatoum in the eye and answered, "No, I don't see him in this room." That portion was shown on television. "All of Damascus was laughing at this episode," Mercier said. "That was not a trial. That was a tragicomedy, a circus." The television cameras showed Eli Cohen's co-defendants, El Ard, Al-Din, Saif, a few prostitutes. But who were the other women? Senior officers' wives? Secretaries? Friends of Tabet and of the Ba'ath leaders? And what were the secrets that Cohen had communicated to his Israeli handlers? He was accused of espionage, but throughout the trial not one word was said about the things he did and the contents of his transmissions. The only thing the cameras couldn't hide was the nervous tremor of a muscle in Cohen's left cheek and a repeated sharp tilting of his head. These were results of his torture by electrodes attached to his body and head. Israel followed the trial in silence. Every evening, Eli's family met by the television set the Mossad had loaned them. The children, Nadia, the brothers, were softly crying at the sight of Eli's face on the screen. His mother, on an impulse, kissed the screen and pressed to Eli's face the small Star of David she was wearing on a chain. Sophie called, "This is my daddy. He is a hero." Nadia wept in silence. In Damascus, Mercier would wake up in the middle of the night, bathed in cold sweat and haunted by horrible nightmares. His inutility depressed him deeply. On March 31st, the military court published its verdict. Eli Cohen, Majid Sheikh El Ard, and Lieutenant Zahir Al-Din were sentenced to death. Mercier launched a new effort. In April and May of 1965, he visited Damascus three times. He brought substantial offers from Israel. The first one was a deal. Israel was ready to deliver to Syria medicines and heavy agricultural equipment, estimated worth millions of dollars, for the life of Cohen.
The Syrians rejected the offer. Israel then made another offer, to send back to Syria the 11 Syrian spies that had been captured and jailed in Israel. The Syrians rejected that offer too, but hinted that a presidential pardon wasn't out of the question. On May 1st, El-Ard's sentence was commuted to life in prison. On May 8th, Eli Cohen's sentence was officially published. The Mossad braced for a last effort. In Paris, Nadia Cohen presented an appeal for clemency at the Syrian embassy. Other appeals came from all over the world. They were signed by world-famous figures like Pope Paul VI and British philosopher Bertrand Russell, statesmen like France's Edgar Faure and Antoine Pinay, Belgium's Queen Mother Elizabeth and politician Camille Oysmans, and Canadian John Diefenbaker, Italian cardinals and ministers, 22 members of British Parliament, the Human Rights League, the International Red Cross. If Eli had heard about them, he would have remembered the similar appeals that tried in vain to save his friends' lives in Cairo 11 years before. On May 18th, in the middle of the night, Eli Cohen was awakened by his jailers. They dressed him in a long white gown and took him to the Damascus marketplace. They let him write a letter to his family and exchange a few words with the Damascus rabbi, Nassim Andabo. Syrian soldiers then fastened to his chest a huge poster where his sentence was written in large Arabic letters. The television and newspaper cameras focused on the lone man who went up the stairs to the gallows between two rows of armed soldiers. The hangman was waiting and quickly fastened the noose around Ali's neck. He made the condemned man stand on a low stool. Eli faced the crowd, silent, resigned, but not defeated. The crowd held its breath. They distinctly heard the thump when the stool was pulled out from under his feet. Men and women yelled with delight watching the death throes of the Israeli spy. Large crowds of Damascenes, mysteriously awakened in the wee hours, passed by the gallows for the next 6 hours to view the body. In Israel, the heavy veil of silence was removed in a single moment. In a few hours, Eli Cohen became a national hero. Hundreds of thousands participated in his family's grief. Schools, streets, and parks were named after him. Articles and books described his feats. Nadia did not marry again. Even today, 46 years after Eli Cohen's death, Syria refuses to return his body for burial in Israel. Eli Cohen is considered one of the Mossad heroes, but there are many who point an accusing finger at the Mossad. His family and various writers contend that the Mossad used Eli with extreme recklessness by having him transmit his reports daily, sometimes twice a day. The Mossad even ordered Eli to transmit regularly the debates of the Syrian parliament, even though their importance was almost nil. A pointless task that made Eli run unnecessary risks. Eli Cohen was a great spy, and his end was the end of all great spies. Their overconfidence and the exaggerated demands of their handlers led them to their deaths. Chapter 10. I want a MiG-21. Meir Amit, Isser Harel's successor, was a special kind of man. He was firm, decisive, sometimes blunt and querulous, but he was also warm, charming, a soldier's soldier and a man of many friends. Moshe Dayan told us once, "He was the only friend I ever had." Meir Amit's life story symbolized the change in the Mossad's leadership. Isser Harel was born in Russia and belonged to the pioneering generation, while Meir Amit, a Sabra, born in Israel, was the first of a long line of Israeli generals. He had fought in Israel's wars and joined the Mossad after many years in uniform. Isser's generation was unobtrusive, close-mouthed, shrouded in a shadow of anonymity, conspiracy, and concealment. Meir Amit was an army man with lots of friends and colleagues who knew what he was doing. Life in the shadows was not for him. And while Little Isser had charisma and mysteriousness on his side, Amit and his successors had the brutal directness and authority that rank and uniform gave them. Born in Tiberias, raised in Jerusalem, and finally a member of Kibbutz Alonim, Meir had spent most of his life in uniform. A member of the Haganah since the age of 16, a battalion commander when the IDF was created, he had been wounded in Israel's independence war and had later made a brilliant army career. Commander of the elite Golani Brigade, chief of operations during the Sinai campaign, chief of the Southern, then the Central Command, he was certainly on his way to becoming chief of staff, but an ill-fated parachute jump immobilized him for a year in a hospital bed. Partly recovered, after a long convalescence and studies at Columbia University, he was appointed chief of Amman. And there, Ben-Gurion found him that dramatic afternoon in April 1963, when he needed a replacement for Little Isser. Meir's first steps in the Mossad were not easy. Many of Isser Harel's colleagues, like Yaakov Karoz, couldn't stand his abrupt manners and his self-confidence. Some resigned right away, others took their time. Under Amit's leadership, a change of the guard began, but the internal turmoil against the new Ramsad was nothing compared to what Little Isser did to him. In the late spring of 1963, Ben-Gurion resigned from office and was replaced as Prime Minister and Minister of Defense by his close aide, Levi Eshkol. Eshkol launched several initiatives that infuriated his predecessor. One of them was appointing Little Isser as his advisor on matters of intelligence. Little Isser was bitter and disappointed after his departure from the Mossad, and when he heard that Meir Amit had done the Moroccans an unusual favor, he went straight for the jugular. Meir Amit's Mossad had established very close relations with the Moroccan kingdom. The Moroccan rapprochement had started during Isser's tenure. The first connections with the Moroccans had been made by Yaakov Karoz and Rafi Eitan. In the winter of 1963, Isser told Eitan in the strictest confidence, Hassan II, the king of Morocco, fears that Egypt's President Nasser plots to assassinate him because of his pro-Western policy. Hassan wants the Mossad to take care of his personal security. The story seemed improbable. An Arab king turns to the Israeli Secret Service for help? The always practical Rafi Eitan and another agent, David Shomron, flew right away to Rabat, the Moroccan capital, with false passports. They were whisked through a secret entrance into the king's palace. There, they met the formidable General Ufkir, the king's Minister of Interior, whose name alone made people tremble. He was known for his cruelty, used torture against the king's enemies, and was responsible for the unexplained disappearances of many opponents of the regime. Nevertheless, he was the king's most valued advisor on intelligence matters, and any agreement between Israel and Morocco needed his approval. He came to Eitan with his deputy, Colonel Dlimi. Right there, Eitan and Ufkir reached an agreement. The Mossad and the Moroccan Secret Service would establish close ties and permanent offices in both countries. The Mossad would train the Moroccan Secret Services, and Morocco would give the Mossad agents a foolproof cover throughout the world. A special body would be created for the shared gathering of intelligence. The Mossad would also train the special unit in charge of the king's security. The agreement was sealed by a visit to the king. Eitan gauchely bowed and kissed his hand, and the Mossad got its first ally in the Arab world. 2 weeks later, Ufkir was in Israel. The general, used to sumptuous palaces and posh hotels, spent his long visit in Eitan's tiny three-room apartment in a modest Tel Aviv neighborhood. Eitan did manage to get Philip, the legendary Mossad chef, to cook for his Moroccan guest. Ufkir left and came again. The relations of the two services kept improving. In 1965, Ufkir asked Meir Amit for a special favor. The major opposition leader and the king's most dangerous enemy was a Moroccan called Mehdi Ben Barka. After being accused of plotting against the king, he had been exiled, but kept directing subversive activities from his hideouts. Sentenced to death in absentia, he knew that his life was in danger. He operated with extreme caution, and Ufkir's men had failed to find him. Could the Mossad help? Amit's men helped indeed. Under a clever pretext, they established contact with Ben Barka in Switzerland and convinced him to come to Paris for an important meeting. At the door of the famous Left Bank restaurant Brasserie Leap, he was arrested by two French police officers who, it turned out later, were on Ufkir's payroll. Ben Barka was delivered to Ufkir and vanished, but a witness testified that he had seen Ufkir stab him to death. Meir Amit himself informed Prime Minister Eshkol, "The man is dead." In France, Ben Barka's disappearance caused an unprecedented political scandal. President de Gaulle was beside himself with rage, and when he heard of Israel's role in the abduction, he didn't spare it in his fury. Isser Harel was stunned. How could the Mossad participate in such an affair? How could Amit play a role in such a criminal, immoral operation and jeopardize Israel's close alliance with France? He asked Eshkol to fire Amit immediately. Eshkol hesitated, but then appointed two boards of inquiry, which found no grounds for any measure against Amit. After all, Amit had lured Ben Barka to Paris, but had not taken part in his abduction and assassination. Little Isser then resigned and demanded the immediate resignation of both Eshkol and Amit. He tried to launch a campaign in the press, but the military censorship strictly forbade any mention of the affair. Isser kept doggedly fighting Amit, but the Ramsad was already engaged in another operation that was utterly crucial to Israel's defense, a secret alliance with the Kurds in Iraq. At the end of 1965, Amit wrote in his memoirs, "Our dream started to become a reality. The unbelievable happened. An official Israeli delegation settled in the camp of the Mullah Mustafa Barzani, the leader of the Kurdish rebels in northern Iraq." The arrival of Mossad officers in Kurdistan was considered a tremendous victory for Israeli intelligence. For the first time, a contact was established with one of the three components of the Iraqi nation, the Kurds, who were waging a stubborn, endless war against the Baghdad government. The other two components were the Shiite and Sunni Muslims. The rebels, led by Barzani, controlled a large area inside Iraq. If the Mossad succeeded in turning the Kurdish rebels into a strong military force, the Iraqi leaders would be compelled to focus their efforts on their internal problems, and their capacity for fighting Israel would be diminished. The alliance with the Kurds could become a real boon for Israel. The first two Mossad agents spent 3 months in Kurdistan. Barzani welcomed them in his inner circle, took them with him wherever he went, and revealed to them all his secrets. That first encounter laid the foundation for a close cooperation that was to last for many years. Barzani and the Kurdish military chiefs visited Israel. Meir Amit and his aides came to Kurdistan. Israel supplied the Kurds with weapons and defended their interests in international forums. Benny Ze'evi, the senior Israeli agent who first visited Kurdistan, had left his wife Galila in London. She was expecting a child. Benny's son, Nadav, was born while his father followed Barzani in the jagged mountains of Kurdistan. A coded telegram reached Ze'evi. It was signed by Rimon, Meir Amit's code name, and read, "The mother and child are in excellent health. Mazel tov." When Barzani heard of the baby's birth, he took 4 stones and marked a lot with them. "This is my gift to your son," he said to Je'evi. "When he grows up, he can come to our country and claim his piece of land." And while his relations with the Kurds were developing, Meir Amit started planning another great Mossad operation, codenamed Yahalom, Diamond, the operation he was perhaps most proud of. During the year preceding Amit's death, we met him several times in his Ramat Gan home. The story started in one of my meetings with General Ezer Weizmann, who was then chief of the Air Force, he began. "We used to have breakfast together every 2 or 3 weeks. In one of these meetings, I asked Ezer what I could do for him as Ramsad. He said right away, 'Meir, I want a MiG-21. I told him, "Have you gone mad? There is not even one such plane in the Western world." The MiG-21 was the most sophisticated Soviet fighter plane at that time. The Russians supplied many of those aircraft to the Arab states. But Ezer stood his ground. "We need a MiG-21, and you should not spare any effort in getting us one." Amit decided to entrust the operation to Rehavia Vardi, a veteran operations officer who had already tried in the past to get a MiG-21 in Egypt or Syria. "We spent many months working on this operation," Vardi said years later. "Our main problem was how to transform the idea into an operation." Vardi sent out the feelers throughout the Arab world. After long weeks, he got a report from Yaakov Nimrodi, Israel's military attaché in Iran. Nimrodi wrote about an Iraqi Jew, Yosef Shemesh, who claimed he knew a pilot that could bring a MiG-21 to Israel. Shemesh, single, smart, a womanizer, and a bon vivant, had an uncanny ability to befriend people and make them trust him. "He was a smooth operator and could be very persuasive," Nimrodi said. "He recruited the pilot in the most professional fashion. He worked on him for a year. Only he could do that, nobody else." Nimrodi decided to test Shemesh. He sent him to perform a few secondary espionage operations. Shemesh passed the test with flying colors, obtaining excellent intelligence. Then, Nimrodi gave him the green light to launch his operation. In Baghdad, Shemesh had a Christian mistress. Her sister Camille was married to the Iraqi Air Force pilot Munir Redfa, also a Christian. Shemesh knew that Redfa was frustrated and bitter. Even though he was an excellent MiG-21 pilot, he was not promoted in rank. Moreover, he was ordered to fly an antiquated MiG-17 to fulfill a disgusting mission, to bomb the Kurd villages. He regarded this as a humiliation and a demotion. He complained to his superiors and was made to understand that as a Christian, he would never be promoted and never become a squadron leader. Redfa, a very ambitious man, concluded that there was no sense in living in Iraq anymore. For almost a year, Shemesh held long conversations with the young pilot and finally succeeded in convincing him to make a short trip to Athens. Using all his eloquence and powers of persuasion, Shemesh explained to the Iraqi authorities that Redfa's wife suffered from a serious illness, and the only way to save her was to have her examined by Western doctors. She must fly to Greece right away, he said, and asked on her behalf that her husband be allowed to join her, as he was the only one in the family who spoke English. The authorities capitulated, and Munir Redfa was allowed to travel with his wife to Athens. There they met another pilot, Colonel Ze'ev Liron, Londoner, an Israeli Air Force officer. Liron, born in Poland and a Holocaust survivor, was the chief of Air Force intelligence. He had been asked by the Mossad to help in the Redfa case. Liron and Redfa had several tête-à-tête discussions. Liron pretended to be a Polish pilot working for an anti-communist organization. Munir told him about his family, his life in Iraq,
and his deep disappointment with his superiors who sent him to bomb Kurd villages. All the able Kurdish men had gone to fight, he said, and those who had stayed in the villages were women, children, and old people. These were the people he had to kill? For him, it was the last straw that made his decision final. He would leave Iraq for good. Following the Mossad's orders, Liron invited Munir to join him on a small Greek island. The Mossad gave Redfa a code name, Yahalom, Diamond. In the serene, tranquil atmosphere of the island, the two men continued their conversations and became good friends. Late one evening, Liron asked Redfa what would happen if he left Iraq with his plane.
They would kill me, Redfa said. Besides, there is no country that would agree to give me asylum.
There is one country that will welcome you with open arms, Liron said, and revealed the truth to his astounded friend.
I am an Israeli pilot, not a Pole.
There was a long silence. Let's talk about this tomorrow, Liron said, and they parted for the night. The following morning, Redfa told Liron he had decided to accept his offer. The two of them started discussing the conditions for Redfa's defection and the sum of money he would get. Redfa was very modest.
Meir Amit told me to offer Redfa a certain amount of money, Liron said later, and to double it if needed, but Redfa immediately accepted my initial offer. We agreed that his family would join him in Israel.
From the Greek island, they flew to Rome. Shemesh and his mistress arrived from Baghdad. A few days later, they were joined by Yehuda Porat, a research officer at Air Force Intelligence, who started debriefing Redfa.
He was polite, very considerate, a man of honor, Porat recalled. He was brave, not talkative. He had none of the inhibitions that you would expect of a man in his situation.
In Rome, Liron and Redfa discussed communication methods. It was agreed that when Redfa heard at Radio Kol Israel in Arabic the popular Arab song Marhabtain Marhabtain, that would be the signal for him to be on his way. But he did not know that while he was meeting his handlers in various cafes in Rome, he was being watched by the heads of the Mossad.
I decided, Meir Amit told us, to have a personal look at the pilot before the operation got into its final stage. I flew to Rome and went to the cafe where the Iraqi pilot and my men were supposed to go. I sat at a neighboring table and waited. Then quite a few people walked into the cafe. The guy made a good impression. I signaled to our officer who was sitting with him that everything was all right, and I left.
During our meeting with Amit, he insisted on reading to us a passage from his book, Head On, which described the group that had walked into the Rome cafe. The Jewish lover, Shemesh, wearing slippers because of a wound in his foot, his mistress, a fat and almost ugly lady, I didn't understand what he saw in her, and Diamond, Munir's code name, a short, sturdy, and broad-shouldered man with a serious face. They didn't know they were being tested. Only when he was convinced that he could trust Diamond did Amit give Rahavia Vardi the order to proceed with the next stage, briefing the Iraqi pilot in Israel. Liron and Redfa returned to Athens to catch a flight to Tel Aviv, but a snag at Athens airport almost ruined the operation. By mistake, Redfa boarded a flight to Cairo instead of Tel Aviv. Only when he boarded the El Al flight did Liron realize that Redfa had vanished.
I was desperate, Liron reported later. I was certain that everything was lost, but a few minutes later, Munir appeared beside me. It turned out that the flight attendants in the Cairo plane counted the passengers, found out that there was an extra passenger, checked the tickets, and sent Munir to the Tel Aviv flight. Redfa spent only 24 hours in Israel. He was briefed and even rehearsed the flight itinerary into Israel. In a Mossad compound, he was taught a secret code. His new friends then took him on a stroll down Allenby Street, one of Tel Aviv's main arteries, and in the evening hosted him in a fine restaurant in Jaffa to make him feel at home. Redfa flew back to Athens, changed planes, and landed in Baghdad in preparation for the last stage. But at that moment, I almost got a heart attack, Amit recalled. A few days before his desertion, the Iraqi pilot decided to sell his home furniture. Now try to imagine the implications of a sudden garage sale by a fighter pilot. I was scared to death that the Iraqi Mukhabarat security service would find out about the sale, would interrogate Redfa, arrest him, and the entire operation would collapse. Thank God the Mukhabarat didn't hear about that, and the stupid sale of this miser's belongings didn't lead to his arrest. Then, another problem. How to get the pilot's family out of Iraq, first to England and later to the United States? He had quite a few sisters and brothers-in-law that had to be taken out of Iraq before he flew. His immediate family, it had been agreed, would be flown to Israel. Redfa's wife didn't know a thing about this, and he was afraid to tell her the truth. He had only told her that they were going to Europe for a long stay. She flew with her two children to Amsterdam. Mossad people waiting there took them on to Paris, where Liron met them. She still had no idea who these people were. They were settled in a small apartment with one double bed, Liron recalled. We sat on this bed, and there, on the night before the flight to Israel, I revealed to her that I was an Israeli officer, that her husband would land in Israel the next day, and that we are going there as well. Her reaction was dramatic. She wept and yelled all night, Liron reported to his superiors. She said that her husband was a traitor, that this was treason against Iraq, and her brothers would kill Munir when they found out what he had done. She wanted to go right away to the Iraqi embassy and tell them what her husband intended to do. She didn't stop screaming and crying all night long. I tried to calm her down. I told her that if she wanted to see him, she had to come to Israel with me. She realized she had no other choice. With swollen eyes and a sick child, she got on the plane, and we flew to Israel. On July 17, 1966, one of the Mossad stations in Europe got a coded letter from Munir, informing them that his flight was approaching. On August 14th, he took off, but a malfunction in the aircraft's electric system made him turn back and land at Rashid Air Base. Later, Amit said, he found out that it was not a serious hitch. The cockpit suddenly filled with smoke because of a burned fuse. If he stayed the course, he would have arrived without any problem, but he didn't want to take risks and returned to base, and I got some more white hairs. 2 days later, Munir Redfa took off again. He stuck to the planned route, and on the Israeli radar screens, a dot appeared, indicating the approach of a foreign aircraft to Israel's airspace. The new Air Force commander, General Mordecai Motti Hod, had let only a couple of pilots in on the mission. They would escort the Iraqi plane to their base. All the other units, pilots, squadrons, and bases of the Air Force were given an order by Hod. Today, you don't do anything, but absolutely anything without a verbal order from me, and you know my voice. Hod didn't want some overzealous pilot to shoot down the enemy aircraft breaching Israel's perimeter. The MiG-21 penetrated into Israel's airspace. Ron Pecker, one of the aces of the Air Force, had been chosen to escort Redfa. Our guest is slowing down, Ron reported to Air Force Control, and signals me with his thumb that he wants to land. He also tilts his wings, which is the international code indicating that he comes in peace. At 8 a.m., 65 minutes after taking off from Baghdad, Redfa landed in the Hatzor Air Base in Israel. A year after the operation started, and 10 months before the 1967 Six-Day War, the Air Force got its MiG-21. The two Mirage fighters that had escorted it from the border landed with it. Meir Amit and his men had accomplished the impossible. The MiG-21, which at that time was considered the crown jewel of the Soviet arsenal and was regarded as the main threat to Western air forces, was now in Israel's hands. After he landed, still stunned and confused, Munir was taken to the home of the Hatzor base commander. Several senior officers threw him a party with inexcusable disregard for the man's feelings. Munir was surprised by the party and at first felt as if he had strayed into another man's wedding, Meir Amit recalled. He sat down in a corner and kept quiet. After a short rest, when he was assured that his wife and children were already on an El Al plane on the way to Israel, Munir Redfa was taken to a press conference. In his statement, he spoke about the persecution of Christians in Iraq, the bombing of the Kurds, and his own reasons for defection. After the press conference, Munir was driven to Herzliya, an oceanfront city north of Tel Aviv, to meet his family. We did our best to calm him down, encourage him, and compliment him for the operation, Meir Amit wrote. I promised him to do all in my power to help him and his family to recover, but I feared the next stage, as we had learned that Munir's family was very problematic. A few days after Munir had landed his MiG in Hatzor, his wife's brother, an officer in the Iraqi army, arrived in Israel. He was accompanied by Shemesh and his lover, Camille. The officer was mad with rage. He had been told that he had to urgently visit his sister, who was very sick, in Europe, and to his amazement, he was taken to Israel. When he met with Munir, he blew his top, called him a traitor, jumped him, and tried to beat him up. He also accused his sister, Munir's wife, of being aware of her husband's plans all along, which made her an accomplice to an unspeakable crime. She denied his accusations, but in vain. A few days later, the brother left Israel. The first to fly the MiG was Danny Shapira, a famous Air Force pilot and the best test pilot in Israel. Moti Hod called him the day after the plane's landing and told him, You're going to be the first Western pilot to fly a MiG-21. Start studying this aircraft, fly it as much as you can, and learn its strengths and its flaws. Shapira met with Redfa. We met in Herzliya a few days after his arrival, Danny Shapira said. When they introduced us, he almost jumped to attention. Later, we met in Hatzor, by the plane. He showed me the switches, we went over the labels that were in Russian and Arabic, and after an hour I told him that I was going to fly the plane. He was amazed. He said, But you haven't completed a course. I explained that I was a test pilot. He seemed very worried and asked to be beside the plane when I took off. I promised. All the senior officers of the Air Force came to Hatzor to watch the maiden flight. Ezer Weitzman, until recently the Air Force commander, was also there. Ezer came to me, Shapira remembered, patted my shoulder and said, Danny, no tricks. Bring the aircraft back, okay? Redfa was also there. I took off, did what I did, and after I landed, Redfa came to me and hugged me. He had tears in his eyes. With pilots like you, he said, the Arabs will never beat you. After a few test flights, the Air Force experts understood why the West held the MiG-21 in such esteem. It flew very high and very fast and weighed a ton less than the French and Israeli Mirage 3. The MiG-21 operation made the headlines of the world press. The Americans were amazed. Soon after, they sent a delegation of technicians and asked to study and fly the aircraft. Israel, however, refused to let them near the plane before the United States shared with it its files on the SAM-2, the new Soviet anti-aircraft missile. The Americans finally agreed. American pilots came to Israel, examined the MiG-21, and flew it. Learning the secrets of the MiG-21 was a tremendous help to the Israeli Air Force and was essential in preparing for the confrontations with the MiGs that finally occurred 10 months later in the Six-Day War of June 1967. That MiG had an important part in the victory of the Israeli Air Force over the Arab Air Forces, and in particular in the destruction of the Egyptian Air Force in a few hours, Amit proudly said. The Mossad and the Israeli Air Force had indeed achieved a tremendous victory, but Munir Redfa and his family paid dearly for it. After his arrival, Munir had a very hard, miserable, and sad life, a senior Mossad officer said. Building a new life for an agent out of his country is almost a mission impossible. Munir felt frustrated, but his family suffered too. A whole family was broken. For 3 years, Munir tried to make Israel his home and even flew Dakota aircrafts for the Israeli oil companies to the Sinai and back. His family lived in Tel Aviv. They were given a cover as Iranian refugees. But Munir's wife, a devout Catholic, was unable to make friends, felt isolated, and couldn't adapt to life in Israel. They finally left and moved to a Western country under false identities. Even there, far from home and relatives, surrounded by local security agents, they felt lonely and feared the long arm of the Iraqi Mukhabarat. In August 1988, 22 years after his desertion, Munir Redfa died at his home of a sudden heart attack. His wife, in tears, called Meir Amit, who had long ago left the Mossad, and told him that earlier that morning, her husband had come down from the second floor of their house and, while standing next to their son, suddenly collapsed in the entrance hall and died instantly. The Mossad held a memorial service for Munir Redfa. Veteran officers couldn't hold back their tears. It was a surreal sight, Liron said. The Israeli Mossad mourns an Iraqi pilot. Following the success of Operation Diamond and the subsequent astounding victory in the Six-Day War, Meir Amit saw an opportunity to launch a new operation. He requested that his superiors demand the release of the Lavon Affair prisoners as part of a POW exchange. The young captives had been rotting in prison for 13 years, with no chance of pardon or early release. Israel, Amit felt, seemed to have forgotten them. Now that the Six-Day War was over, Israel was in negotiations with Egypt. Israel had captured 4,338 Egyptian soldiers and 830 civilians, while Egypt only captured 11 Israelis. Yet the Egyptians firmly refused to include the Lavon Affair prisoners in the deal. Meir Amit wouldn't let go. Forget about it, Meir, Minister of Defense Moshe Dayan told his friend. The Egyptians will never release them. Prime Minister Eshkol agreed, but Amit refused to give up. He finally sent a personal note to President Nasser, as a soldier to a soldier, and demanded the prisoner's release, as well as that of Wolfgang Lutz, the Champagne spy, who had been arrested during the German scientists' affair. Amit negotiated for a prisoner exchange with the Syrians as well. He had a personal stake in this negotiation. He asked the Syrians to help release Mrs. Shula Cohen from her Lebanese jail. Shula Cohen, codenamed The Pearl, was one of the legendary Mossad spies. A simple housewife, she had established relations with high-placed leaders in Lebanon and Syria, organized the clandestine emigration of thousands of Syrian and Lebanese Jews, and directed a highly successful spy ring. To his amazement, his plea to Nasser worked, and the Syrians followed suit soon after. Meir Amit won. In a covert transaction, the Lavon Affair prisoners, Lutz and Shula Cohen, were returned to Israel. Sometimes the missions to bring home a nation's own are the most meaningful. Chapter 11. Those Who'll Never Forget. In early September 1964, a bald, sturdy man in his mid-40s, wearing sunglasses, arrived in the Rotterdam railway station in Holland on the express train from Paris. He checked into the luxurious Rhein Hotel in the city center under the name Anton Kunzle, an Austrian businessman. He then went to the nearby post office and rented a P.O. box under the same name. From the post office, he went to Amro Bank, opened an account, and deposited $3,000. At a printer's shop, he ordered business cards and stationery in the name of Anton Kunzle, manager of an investment company in Rotterdam. From there, he hurried to the Brazilian consulate and filled out forms for a tourist visa to Brazil. At a doctor's clinic, he underwent a perfunctory checkup and got a medical certificate about his health, then visited an optometrist, cheated during the test, and ordered thick magnifying glasses, even though he didn't need them at all.